Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 6th canto, chapter 17, entitled Mother Parvati Curses Chituketu. We're going to read text 16 and 17. Which one's on the board? 17. Okay, so I'll just read 16 first and then we can do 17 together. Sri Shuku Vacha Evam. We're almost there. Sri Shuku Vacha Evam Shaptas Chitra Ketur Vimanad Avaruhyasa Prasadayam Asasatim Murdna Namrena Bharata. Sri Shukadev Goswami continued, My dear King Parikshit, when Chitraketu was cursed by Parvati, he descended from his airplane, bowed before her with great humility, and pleased her completely. Text 17, please repeat. Chitraketu vacha pratigrinhamite shapam atmanon jalinambike devair martyaya yat proktam purvadishtam hitasyatat pratigrinhamite shapam atmanon jalinambike devair martyaya yat proktam purvadishtam hitasyatat pratigrinhamite shapam atmanon jalinambike devair martyaya yat proktam purvadishtam hitasyatat. Pratigrinamite shapam atmanon jalinambike devar martyaya prokam pratigrinamite shapam Atmanon Jalinambike Deva Martyaya Proktam Pratigrinhamite Shapam Atmanon Jalinambike Devar Martyaya Proktam Purvadishtam Hitasya Tat. Ladies, please. Chitraketu Ruvacha Patikrinamite Shapam Atmanon Jalinambike Devar Martyaya Proktam Purvadishtam hitasya tat Chitraketurvacha Pratigrinhamite shapam Atmanon jalinambike Devar martyaya yat proktam Purvadishtam hitasya tat Chittiketu vacha. Patigrinami te shapam. Atmanan jalinam bike. Deva matyai proktam. Purvadistam hitasyata. Chittiketu uvacha. King Chittiketu said, Pratigrinami, I accept te, your shapam, curse, atmana, my own, anjalina, with folded hands, ambike, O mother, devai, by the demigods, matyaya, unto a mortal, yat, which, proktam, prescribed, purvadishtam, fixed previously, according to one's past deeds. He, indeed, tasya, of him, tat, that. Translations and purport by His Divine Grace. Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Chittiketu said, my dear mother, with my own hands folded together, I accept the curse upon me. I do not mind the curse, for happiness and distress are given by the demigods as a result of one's past deeds. Purport, since Chittiketu was a devotee of the Lord, he was not at all disturbed by the curse of Mother Parvati. He knew very well that one suffers or enjoys the results of one's past deeds as ordained by Daiva Netra, superior authority, or the agents of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He knew that he had not committed any offense at the lotus feet of Lord Shiva or the goddess Parvati, yet he had been punished, and this means that the punishment had been ordained. Thus the king did not mind it. A devotee is naturally so humble and meek that he accepts any condition of life as a blessing from the Lord. A devotee always accepts punishment from anyone as the mercy of the Lord. If one lives in this conception of life, he sees whatever reverses occur to be due to his past misdeeds, and therefore he never accuses anyone. On the contrary, he becomes increasingly attached to the Supreme Personality of Godhead because of his being purified by his suffering. Suffering, therefore, is also a process of purification. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says in this connection that one who has developed Krishna consciousness and who exists in love with Krishna is no longer subject to suffering and happiness under the laws of karma. Indeed, he is beyond karma. The Brahma Samhita says, Karmani nirdahati kintu cha bhakti bhajam. A devotee is free from the reactions of his karma because he has taken to devotional service. This same principle is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, Sagunan samatityai tan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. One who is engaged in devotional service has already been freed from the reactions of his material karma, and thus he immediately becomes Brahmabhuta, or transcendental. This is also expressed in Srimad Bhagavatam, Shiyante chasya karmani. Before attaining the stage of love, one becomes free from all the results of karma. The Lord is very kind and affectionate toward his devotees, and therefore a devotee, in any condition, is not subjected to the results of karma. A devotee never aspires for the heavenly planets. The heavenly planets, liberation and hell, are non-different for a devotee, for he does not discriminate between different positions in the material world. A devotee is always eager to return home back to Godhead and remain there as the Lord's associate. This ambition becomes increasingly fervent in his heart, and therefore he does not care about material changes in his life. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments that Maharaj Chittiketu's being cursed by Parvati should be considered the mercy of the Lord. The Lord wanted Chittiketu to return to Godhead as soon as possible, and therefore he terminated all the reactions of his past deeds. Acting through the heart of Parvati, the Lord, who is situated in everyone's heart, cursed Chittiketu in order to end all his material reactions. Thus Chittiketu became Dhritarasura in his next life and returned home back to Godhead. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Om agyana timarandasya gyananjana shalakaya chakshurun miritam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasari Gaura Bhaktavinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Mukham Karoti Vachalam Panvam Nangayate Gurim Yat Kripa Tamaham Vande Shri Gurum Dinatananam. Even though I'm lame and unintelligent, still with the mercy of my spiritual master and Srila Prabhupada and all the assembled Vaishnavas, hopefully we can say something relevant in this verse and purport. It reminds me of a story from the Mahabharata. Nearing the time of the battle of Kurukshetra, when things are starting to get very, very heavy between the Kurus and Maharaj Yudhisthira and his camp, Maharaj Yudhisthira personally asked Krishna to go to the camp of the Kurus, to their assembly, and as an emissary of peace. And Krishna, of course, loves to serve his devotees, and so he took this humble position and went to Hastinapur. This is just a few days before the battle took place. And as a lot of you know, having heard the story, the particularly difficult situation was that Duryodhana, the son of Dhritarashtra, was so obstinate. He was such a rascal, as Prabhupada would say, that he just wouldn't accept any good advice about not getting into the war. He refused to listen to it. He was so proud. He was so egotistical. And even though Krishna himself personally came and spoke to him, although very briefly, telling him not to get in this war, it would surely cause the destruction of your whole dynasty, you're going to regret it, you're really out of your mind, don't do it. And everyone else in the assembly was agreeing, his own father and mother telling him, Duryodhana, you have to get out of this, you completely lost it. Still, he was so stubborn, he said, no, we're going to fight. So at some point someone asked him, I can't remember who, I think it was Dhritarashtra. He said, why are you like this? Why are you so stubborn? And Duryodhana said something that's very interesting for us to think about. He said, I am whatever God has made me. It is he who has designed me and he who has decided my fate. I will act exactly as he has directed and not otherwise. Which sounds very, very pious, right? I'm just whatever God has made me and I just do whatever he's directed for me. It's my destiny as ordained by the Lord. It sounds very pious, but it's philosophically naive, actually. This sort of hyper-piety, you could call it, where one makes this speculation that because God is everything, therefore anything that's happening, anything that I do, is somehow ordained and divine. In this way, we try to dodge responsibility for our activities and for rendering service to the Lord. This happened previously in the time of Martin Luther, for those of you who know about the Lutheran Church. He had this whole perspective, and it was quite popular at the time. You know, seemingly coming across as just being so pious that everything is in the hands of the Lord, absolutely everything, and there's nothing that you can do that has any sort of that makes any sort of difference in the course of events in your life or in others, and in your well-being or in others. It's simply everything within the hands of Krishna. Of course, he wasn't saying Krishna, Martin Luther, but... And it sounds really nice, but unfortunately it's just not true. Krishna says that he's equal to everyone, and yet he has special favor for, he has special reciprocation with those who are his devotees. It's something that's very... it can be a little bit difficult for us to understand, but it's important to understand, so that we don't become subject to the ramifications of these sort of speculations, which has plagued other religious cultures for so long. Krishna says, Samaham sarva bhuteshu na me dvesha stina priya ye bhajanti tamam bhaktya mai te teshu chapyaham. He says, I'm equal to everyone. I don't see anyone as being an enemy or a friend. But someone who serves me with bhakti, naturally I have some special inclination for them. Which seems like, didn't you just say you're equal to everyone? How is there special inclination? Certainly there's some sort of bias on the part of the Lord, right? And again, in the history of religious cultures, we see that practically everybody likes to advertise themselves as being the Lord's own people, the chosen one, so on and so forth. And it's very dangerous speculation, very dangerous. However, of course, we get to hear from Srila Prabhupada, who makes it very, very clear, so we don't have to speculate, that Krishna is equal to everyone, but we are independent to serve the Lord with devotion, and so that reciprocation from the Lord is different. The point being that you, as a devotee, you have a responsibility for serving Krishna. You can't just put everything into his hands in the sense that, you know, he should just make everything happen perfectly. Rather, we have to endeavor to serve the Lord and get that reciprocation that we do. We see a good example of how this works, again, in the pastime of Duryodhana and Arjuna. Because just a few days after Krishna himself went and was pleading for peace and whatnot, and it was all becoming quite clear that, no, it's not going to happen, we're going to fight. And all the kings on both sides had to pick sides to fight. And so Duryodhana was going, you know, making his alliances and allegiances with various powerful kings and their armies. And similarly, Maharaj Yudhishthira and Arjuna were also going out, making their alliances. Everyone's trying to amass their armies on each side because they knew it was all going to come together and you got to be prepared. So, of course, both Duryodhana and Arjuna thought, why not get Krishna on our side? And so they both went to Dwarka to see Krishna. And it just so happens that they arrived almost at exactly the same time. Just that Duryodhana was practically a few minutes earlier to Krishna's palace. As Arjuna's riding up to the palace, he sees Duryodhana being allowed in by the temple guards. I'm sorry, his palace guards. Duryodhana was escorted into Krishna's own room first, and Arjuna immediately afterwards. It just so happened that as part of his incredible transcendental pastimes, Krishna was having a nap. And he's lying down in a bed of sorts, like this. I don't know if his hands were behind his head, but anyway, he's lying on his back, looking this direction. Duryodhana, of course, he's not one to really observe the rules of etiquette and respectfulness very well. And so he came into Krishna's room and he sat down right next to Krishna's bed. You know, he picked the finest chair in the room and sat down right by Krishna's head, here. Arjuna came in and also saw Krishna lying there, and Duryodhana lying there. But Arjuna, his sentiment is totally different from Duryodhana. His sentiment is that of devotion. So rather than, you know, arrogantly, you know, sitting right next to the Lord's bed, he very humbly and submissively sat at the foot of the bed with hands folded, like we just heard, Anjali Sa in this verse, with hands folded, meditating on the Lord's lotus feet. And so when Krishna woke up, so to speak, who did he see first? He saw Arjuna. And then, of course, Duryodhana draws some attention to himself. And Duryodhana explained to him the obvious situation, the battle of Kurukshetra. The battle is going to happen any day now, and we want to fight for us. He said, I've heard from all the great sages that you're like, I don't know, the supreme person or something, and so you're supposed to be equal to everyone. This is Duryodhana's piety. He's heard the philosophy. He said, I heard from Narada Muni, Vyasadeva, they said that you're like, I don't know, the super soul, you know, the most powerful yogi or whatever, maybe even God. And so therefore you should be equal to everyone. And I got here first, and so you should accept my request first. And Krishna said, that's true. And although you are in a superior position, Duryodhana, still, I saw Arjuna first. And so I'm going to give him the first request. And so that's, as you know, this is the point where Krishna said, I'm not personally going to fight, but whoever decides, one of you can have my army, you know, 100 million Yadava soldiers, all equal in power to me, or you can have me myself. And Arjuna, I'll let you choose first. And of course, Arjuna's decision was, Krishna, I just want to have you. And Duryodhana was, oh, well, okay, I guess I'll take the 100 million Yadava soldiers, all equal in power to Krishna himself. And of course, he stormed out angrily. And Arjuna stayed there. The point being that although Krishna is equal to everyone, the philosophy is correct. God is equal to everyone. Still, a devotee puts him or herself into the position to receive the special reciprocation from the Lord. That's the thing. So you have that independence. Krishna's invested in us, that independence to act in that way. To choose Krishna over our own fruitive activities. You can't just say that I am whatever God has made me. It is He who decides my fate. I shall act as He has directed and not otherwise. It's not that simple. Rather, Krishna really appreciates that those who have the opportunity, of course, going back to the point, it's true that those who have never been introduced to any sort of spiritual technology, particularly Krishna consciousness, really have very little facility to act independently, to choose anything over the reactions of their karma. And that's the very unfortunate condition, and that's why we're engaged in Sankirtan, of course, to give them that opportunity. But for those of us, at least, we have the independence to choose Krishna at any moment. And Krishna likes that. He likes that we have that independence. Hence this verse being quoted here. Tate nukampam susamikshamanha bunjana evatma kritam vipakam ridvag vapurbir viradan namaste jivete yo mukti pade sadhayabhag. This is a really special verse. Srila Prabhupada said it's the, what is the exact word? He said it should be the motto of the devotees. I can't remember the exact words, but he stressed it as being very important. And it's a verse spoken by Lord Brahma, and he used a really nice poetic device to emphasize how important this is. He says that a devotee is someone who, despite receiving the constant reactions of their previous activities, despite suffering because of it, they're always offering obeisances unto the Lord with their mind, with their body, with their words. Nothing stops them from that devotional service. And he also says that Krishna, although he's completely independent, it's his causeless mercy to reciprocate with that person. It becomes that person's rightful claim, that Krishna is practically forced to reciprocate with such pure devotional service. Even though it's his causeless mercy, nothing can cause it to happen. Still, Lord Brahma is saying Krishna must reciprocate with that person. Sadhaya bhak. It becomes that person's rightful claim. So Krishna really appreciates this, that we have this independence and we choose Krishna over Maya. That's the platform of real love and reciprocation. Not that we just have some sort of, some sort of monotonous, homogenous, simply regimented lifestyle surrender. Rather, the whole purpose of surrendering to this regiment, to this regulation, is for, as we're hearing in this verse, purification, coming to that platform of independently choosing Krishna. Not just whimsically, and not just impelled by lusty desire, but out of pure love. That's the whole point, really, of all of the scriptural injunctions, of all of our rules and regulations, of all of our practice of austerities, is to come to this platform of independence, to choose Krishna, which is pure love and devotion. That's the whole thing. That's real surrender. It's not just like, we always have this conception of surrender when, like, you know, one army is losing to another army and you just have to, like, give up. Okay, give up. Like, quit. You win. You're powerful. And I'm not. And that's great. You know, a great way to start. They say the fear of God is the beginning of knowledge. But there's something a lot deeper. There's a lot deeper potential in the culture of bhakti. And so the goal is freedom. That's the arena of pure love and devotion. So Krishna's instructions is for that purification of the heart so that we can choose Krishna. You know, because we have this old conception of God, most of us coming from, you know, Judeo-Christian background and living in the midst of that society, as God as being like, you know, this sort of overlord, you know, sort of dude who needs to go to anger management classes or something, like got some real heavy problems and is taking it out on all of his creation. And that we should be very fearful of damnation and the fire and the brimstone and all that sort of stuff. If we don't follow his laws and his rules, we'll be condemned. And it's true, there's condemnation for someone who doesn't follow the instructions of Krishna. But we should try to see that Krishna is more like that of a competent doctor. When you go to a doctor, they give you all sorts of regulations and rules. But it's for your betterment. It's for your well-being. So that ultimately you can become independent again. When they tell you, you can't eat this, you can't do that, you have to sleep so much or not so much or whatever, so many different things. It's so that we can become healthy, come to our natural condition. Ideally, unless the doctor's like crazy or trying to make money, which is quite common these days. My mother, of course, works and she used to work in pharmaceutical sales, and she told me all about it. They get plenty of money for prescribing certain things, and so most doctors these days aren't really in that category. But we can at least imagine the archetype, the ideal, that a competent doctor wants to see you become healthy. So similarly, Krishna's instructions are objectively beneficial for every living entity. It's not like he's got some sort of power trip, you know. Like he just like whimsically chose one thing to be good and one thing to be bad, one thing to be pious and one thing to be evil. And we're just so inferior that we just have to do it simply because Krishna just said it. It's not just like that. Not quite that simple. Like Krishna decides, you know, my favorite ice cream is chocolate ice cream, and so chocolate chip. And so if you like vanilla, you know, you're going to go to hell, or something like that. Which is kind of a crude example, but that's really how some other religious cultures are presenting the philosophy. Rather, we should see that it's with Krishna's instructions for one's objective, it's objectively beneficial for our purification. So when Krishna says, don't eat cows, I don't know if he like ever literally, you know, said it somewhere, but when the Vedic injunctions, they say, coming from Krishna, when they say, you know, don't eat cows, don't eat meat, it's not like he just whimsically decided that that should be extra sinful. Rather, it's objectively beneficial for you to refrain from an activity which is so exploitative and violent for your purification of your existence. Krishna is unaffected by karmic activity. It's not like he needs our pious activities, you know, to maintain his position. Like Nietzsche became famous for saying, God is dead, let's all just stop worshipping and then it'll just go away. That's not quite how it works. He doesn't need the pious activities of living entities. Rather, when he suggests one thing is being pious and one is being impious, it's for our purification. So it's really important to understand these philosophies a bit more comprehensively because, you know, a lot we see in the history of all religious culture that every time there's these sort of speculations, you know, we don't get to hear from the acharyas and try to understand from pure devotees. When these speculations come out, it just wreaks havoc in the world, large-scale havoc in the name of, you know, God consciousness. And so we don't want to make that mistake of such convenient speculations. Like Duryodhana said, I am whatever God has made me, as he decides my fate. I shall act as he has dictated, not otherwise. It's convenient speculation, but philosophically naive. And it happens so much, unfortunately. There is this, I'll tell you one short story, that there's this group in New Zealand, well, they're not a group anymore, praise the Lord. There's this fellow named Brian Tamaki. I don't know if any of you ever heard him in the news. He made international news for a little while. The self-appointed bishop, Brian Tamaki. And he became a little bit of a cult leader for a while. He was quite popular. He made some sort of claim that he's going to take over the country in 5 years. And a lot of people were really getting on to it. It was this sort of, what is the word? Some sort of Christian group. And they subscribed to this prosperity theology. I don't know if any of you have ever heard this. Prosperity theology is the seemingly rational conclusion that God favors those who are his pious servants and children with prosperity. And so to the degree that I have prosperity, I must be very pious. I must be one of God's chosen ones. Which sounds really, really dumb, but somehow a lot of people got into it. And so he convinced a few people of this. And so naturally, because he established himself as being more pious because of having his wealth, people gave him more and more wealth, and he eventually got millions, millions of dollars. Millions. I mean, it was like really a threat. The prime minister was like, they were sending all these sorts of secret agent spies to him and all this sort of stuff, trying to figure out what he was doing. Of course, it happens. Our own history has some things similar. But fortunately, we're quite different from Brian Tamaki because our philosophy isn't just resting on some convenient speculation. Eventually, this guy got so into himself, really got out of hand. He was getting so many followers. He was crossing over the gap, as they say, into Australia. He was starting some churches there. It was called Destiny Church. I don't mean any offense to them, but they should have seen it coming. It was called Destiny Church. And again, he started getting into politics. He started his own political movement. It's called New Zealand First. I think it was called New Zealand First, something like that. And they were doing really well. They were getting a lot of followers, you know. It was getting really big and scary for some people that this really fanatical church was, like, amassing heaps of money and getting in some power. And there's this one, I saw this news story where a reporter from one of the local news stations went undercover to some sort of ceremony where this Bishop Brian Tamaki was kind of like initiating disciples. It was like 100 men had paid some inordinate amount of money. You know, they get this sort of like ring, like they're married to the bishop, and there's this whole ritual. And so this reporter went in undercover, you know, with the cameras and the microphones and all this stuff. And, you know, there's like this huge arena, and there's all these people there, and like the lights and the rock and roll music, and it's all like really intense, you know. And Bishop Brian Tamaki comes out on the stage and he says, "I am God! I am God!" Whoa. Everybody just kind of like freaked out. It went straight to his head. He started talking about how he's simultaneously King David from the Bible, and I'm God, and I'm the chosen one, and all this sort of stuff. And it was all caught on these news, by these news reporters' cameras. And they, of course, put it out as much as possible. And suffice to say, this guy lost his popularity pretty quickly. And there's this whole split, and everybody was trying to fight for his money, of course. But that's the inevitable result of every sort of speculation. As we come back to that same point, I must be the supreme. I must be in control. Who is speculating that I must be the eternal servant of Krishna? Who speculates like that? You don't have to, because it's described in Srimad Bhagavatam on every page. So this is why we're very fortunate to hear from Bhagavatam, from Srila Prabhupada. So we don't have these same sort of philosophical hang-ups and difficulties that has plagued religious culture for so many years. And by understanding these things in depth, hearing from the acharyas how it is that Krishna is equal to everyone, unbiased, and yet has special reciprocation for his devotees, when we understand that philosophically very deeply, it helps us to come off the neophyte platform, the stage of Kanishta Adhikari, in which, you know, anything can really shake us up. Anytime someone says something to us, it can really cause us to become confused. We'll come to a much higher level of understanding Krishna. We'll come to a much more independently motivated, liberated position so that we can choose Krishna. And ultimately, this is what's most pleasing to Krishna and to Srila Prabhupada. They want us to come to this higher level, not to remain philosophically naive. Therefore, we should take seriously the opportunity to read Srimad Bhagavatam, to understand Krishna's instructions in this way. So I'll finish with that point. Ask if there's any comments or challenges or retorts, questions. Multiplications, additions, subtractions, divisions. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam Aki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Aki Jai, Gaur Premanandi. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya.